Now call on Brother Mark Kerr to read for us Isaiah chapter 28.
Reading with you, Isaiah chapter 28. Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat bellies of them that are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one, which as a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, as a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with the hand. The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, shall be trodden under feet. And the glorious beauty which is on the head of the fat valley shall be a fading flower, and as the hasty fruit before the summer, which when he that looketh upon it seeth, while it is yet in his hand, he eateth it up. In that day shall Yahweh of armies be for a crown of glory, and for a diadem of his beauty unto the residue of his people, and for a spirit of judgment to him that sitteth in judgment, and for strength to them that turn the battle to the gate. But they also have erred through wine, and through strong drink are out of the way. The priest and the prophet have erred through strong drink. They are swallowed up of wine. They are out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. For all tables are full of vomit and filthiness, so that there is no place clean. Whom shall he teach knowledge? And whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breasts? For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. For with stammering lips and another tongue will he speak to this people, to whom he said, "This is the rest wherewith you may cause the weary to rest, and this is the refreshing," yet they would not hear. But the word of Yahweh was unto them precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little and there a little, that they might go and fall backward and be broken and snared and taken. Wherefore hear the word of Yahweh, ye scornful men, that rule this people which is in Jerusalem. Because ye have said, "We have made a covenant with death, and with hell are we at agreement. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, it shall not come unto us, for we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves." Therefore thus saith Yahweh God, "Behold, I lay in Zion for a foundation a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste. Judgment also will I lay to the lion, and righteousness to the plummet. And the hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters shall overflow the hiding place. And your covenant with death shall be disannulled, and your agreement with hell shall not stand. When the overflowing scourge shall pass through, then ye shall be trodden down by it. From the time that it goeth forth it shall take you, for morning by morning shall it pass over, by day and by night, and it shall be a vexation only to understand the report. For the bed is shorter than that a man can stretch himself on it, and the covering narrower than that he can wrap himself in it. For Yahweh shall rise up as in Mount Perazim, he shall be wroth as in the valley of Gibeon, that he may do his work, his strange work, and bring to pass his act, his strange act. Now therefore be ye not mockers, lest your bands be made strong. For I have heard from the Lord God of armies a consumption even determined upon the whole earth. Give ye ear and hear my voice, hearken and hear my speech. Doth the ploughman plough all day to sow? Doth he open and break the clods of his ground? When he hath made plain the face thereof, doth he not cast abroad the fitches, and scatter the cumin, and cast in the principal wheat and the appointed barley, and the rye in their place? For his God doth instruct him to discretion, and doth teach him. For the fitches are not threshed with a threshing instrument, neither is a cart wheel turned about upon the cumin, but the fitches are beaten out with a staff, and the cumin with a rod. Bread corn is bruised, because he will not ever be threshing it, nor break it with the wheel of his car, nor bruise it with his horsemen. This also cometh forth from Yahweh of armies, which is wonderful in counsel and excellent in working.
Thanks for that reading, Mark. We'll now ask Glenn to address us on the subject of Samaria.
Thanks, Tim. Okay, what I want to do this evening is spend about 10-15 minutes just focusing on the actual city of Samaria. We know that in the Old Testament times that when the nation of Israel split into two, we know that the southern one became known as Judea and the northern one became known as Samaria or Ephraim. So what you want to do is just have a brief look at where Samaria came from and what it looked like, so as we can appreciate the contents of what Uncle Brian's going to consider in Isaiah chapter 28. So before we actually get started, what I might do is just get a brief brainstorm on what maybe you people know about Samaria. So while I'm writing this up, you can all think about some characters or a few points on what you know about Samaria. Now the actual place or town, as we'll see later, excuse my writing, means a watchtower, and it was fairly aptly named because when the king who chose it for a place to set his fortress, we know that it was a fairly strategic one in relation to the northern kingdom, and especially in relation to the Assyrians. So what are some characters or some points that you think, or that you've got on Samaria? I'll get a bit of fast participation first off, so warm up for Uncle Brian's question session later on. Can't be too long because I've only got 10 minutes. It's all on Samaria, it's like we've got lots.
Yep. Any Old Testament happenings?
Well, the woman of Samaria is like the cross for Jacob's quote, so Jacob must have had something to do with it.
By the end of the night, we might enhance your knowledge about Samaria. Geographically, Samaria was located on a fairly steep rising hill, supposedly about 600 metres above the valley floor. Now, on this map here, you won't find Samaria. I took a few minutes to try and find it myself, but basically where it is we can see where Shechem is, and there's Tirzah. We'll read a bit about Tirzah in a moment, but Samaria was situated in a valley or a depression, and this depression and valley ran from Shechem, ran north and then west across to the Mediterranean coast. It was about 23 miles from the coast, the actual city of Samaria, and roughly lay about 7 to 8 miles northwest of Shechem. We know it's in the vicinity of roughly about here, because Dothan, as we'll see in a slide later on, is in the northerly direction from Samaria. So what we want to do is pick up the story. We'll just have a brief account of where Samaria started. So if we can turn to 1 Kings chapter 16. Here we find the beginnings of what we know as Samaria in the Old Testament times. If we can get Paul to read 1 Kings 16 verse 23 and 24 for us. Okay, so there we have the fact that Tirzah, king who, the place I mean, Omri, ruled in Tirzah for roughly 6 years, after which he decided to move the capital of the northern kingdom up a few miles to what we know today as Samaria. And that move was in about 800 BC when King Omri decided to make the move. And when he made the move, he chose the place as a very strategic position. And as we'll see later, that strategic position was well thought out, because when it came time for the Assyrians to actually take the city, it took them about 3 years to seize the city and eventually take it. The actual city fell to the Assyrians in about 722 or to 720 BC. The reason it fell was because, as we read in verse 25 and 26, nearly every single king after King Omri did evil, that which was did evil in the eyes of Yahweh. And there we read that Omri wrought evil in the eyes of Yahweh, and did worse than all that were before him. But he walked in all the way of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, and in his sin wherewith he made Israel to sin. And because of that, he provoked Yahweh to anger. And because of that provoking, Yahweh decided to bring judgments upon them. And you also may like to take note of Amos chapter 6 and verses 1 and 8, because in there, the prophet Amos describes that the northern kingdom would go into captivity. In 1 Kings 20, Samaria was actually unsuccessfully seized by Ben-Hadad, who was king of Assyria at the time. And the next story or reference we have of Samaria is in 2 Kings chapter 15, where Assyria was growing in power, and the king of Samaria, or Ephraim, thought it wise to pay tribute to the king of Assyria. Next one we come to, the next Jewish king was Pekah, and he adopted a fairly anti-Assyrian policy, because he put all his trust in the fact that Egypt might deliver them if there was any event of conflict between Ephraim and Assyria. But we know well the outcome of that. In 2 Kings chapter 17, we have the actual fall of Samaria. Turn to that and we'll read verses 3 to 6. If we can get Jason to read those verses for us.
And that thing came up, Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, and Ashir became the servant in days of Persia. And the king of Assyria had conspiracy in Ashir, for he had sent messengers to Sodom. No presence in Assyria, yet done year by year. Therefore the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. And the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land, went up to Samaria, and seized it for 3 years. In the ninth year, Ashur, the king of Assyria, Samaria, and carried Israel away to Assyria, placed it in Halah and Habor by the river of Gozan, and the cities of the Midlands.
Thanks. And I was saying before the fact that God brought judgments upon the nation because of their evilness. And from verse 7 to basically the end of the chapter, it deals with why the Assyrians came down and took Samaria and the Israelites captive. So once Omri died, and he died in about 873 BC, another king rises on the scene, a king by the name of Ahab, which we would all be familiar of. And Ahab was much worse a king than his father. So if you read in 1 Kings chapter 16 and verse 30, the actual verses here seem to paint a picture that Ahab had in his mind that his father was fairly wicked, but Ahab wanted to go one step further. Verse 30, "And Ahab the son of Omri did evil in the sight of Yahweh above all that were before him. And it came to pass as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, that he took to wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him." So here we're coming into the times when the actual nation of Israel, I suppose you could say, did worse than the actual Canaanites and the nations that talked around them. The actual kingdom that Ahab inherited was fairly fairly untroubled, both in a political and an economic sense. His father had built a relationship with the Phoenicians and trade was prospering. Now we know that Ahab continued on the building program that his father instituted. Ahab enlarged the city and improved the actual defences of the city by building an outer wall, which archaeological finds tell us that it's quite an extensive outer wall. And we also know that Ahab, in 1 Kings 22 and verse 39, was famous for the building of an ivory palace or a palace that was fairly well decorated in ivory furniture and ornaments. Now the actual really interesting point that we want to look at in the remaining time that we've got is some of the archaeological finds that have taken place in and around Samaria. These finds, as is always the case, prove the fact that Bible history and Bible accounts of past kings, etc., were true. Now, these finds that we'll have a look at, basically, as the slides will show also, the actual hill of Samaria has several layers of Israeli occupation. The lowest two of those levels, levels 1 and 2, have been determined that they're from the age of Omri and from Ahab. And the finds that were found, the diggings that took place, found that the actual inner wall that Omri built around the city was about 5 feet thick, but the outer wall, which Ahab built to increase the defences of the city, was about 19 feet thick. So it's a fairly big and main walls that they decided to build. We also can have a look at the main gateway that has been dug up and found. And that roughly looks like this. So there you have the actual entrance to the city of Samaria. These walls here and the other walls that we'll have a look at were said to be made of Phoenician construction. There's a lot of Phoenician architecture and ivory work that apparently was found by the archaeologists. Apparently they proved that point I haven't quite determined it, but they say that the way these stones are laid, and as you've seen another overhead, the way those stones are laid is proof that there was some kind of Phoenician architecture in the actual city itself. Once again, you just have the walls of Samaria. And up here, this isn't actually taken from Samaria, but that's just an example of some of the ivory work that was found in that era of time. Okay, so we've said that there was a lot of Phoenician architecture and design work in the making of Samaria. How do you think, just as an aside, how do you think that that kind of architecture came about to be in the city of Samaria? Remembering that King Ahab was king at the time.
His wife.
Where did his wife come from?
His wife.
Where did she come from?
From
Yeah, that's right. She came, as you read in verse 31, from she was a daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Zidonians, and Tyre and Sidon were in that area of Phoenicia. So it looks like she had quite a lot to do with the building and the construction and the planning of Ahab's palace and the actual city of Samaria. This overhead doesn't show up fairly well, but never mind. The gradient of the hill of Samaria is remembering that it was about 600 feet from the top of from the bottom of the valley floor. But there we have some evidence of the fact that the Romans and the Greeks used Samaria also in their time. So once the king of Assyria took them captive, it wasn't just decimated, but rather a lot of other work went on when the Greeks and Romans took it over. And because of the fact that it was on a hilltop and commanded such a prominent position in the valley from Shechem to the Mediterranean coast, the Jews thought themselves fairly safe against any intrusions from any northern kingdoms or even from their brothers from the kingdom of Judea. And so that's where they placed all their pride and all their superstitions in the fact that because of these walls and the prominent position on the hilltop, they couldn't be taken. But we know full well that, as we've looked at before, that God brought an end to that way of thinking. Here's a pictorial of what it looked like. We're mainly interested in this section here because most of this here was built by the Greeks and Romans. Here you have the palace of ivory that Ahab built. One other interesting thing is this pool over here. Was found in the northwest corner. It was made of rock and layered with cemented stones of slab. We know that in 1 Kings, I mean, there's no way that we can 100% prove this point, but in 1 Kings 22, in verses 37 to 38, it talks about there of the death of Ahab and how they brought his chariot back to Samaria and washed it in a pool. It may well be, who knows, it may well be that that was the very pool that that his chariot was washed in. So what we want to do now is, we've just got about six slides that might help in giving you a bit of a pictorial of what Samaria was like. So I might just those on now if we can. Okay, here we have a view of from Samaria, but this one's, we mentioned before that the next city up or next country town up was Dathan. So here we have looking north up towards Dathan, and you can see from that the extent of the incline of from the valley floor to the top of Samaria. And we have that valley that encircles the whole hilltop. And I think the next slide shows that a bit more. Now this one's looking west towards the Mediterranean Sea, where that valley takes its course. And looking west, the valley develops into fairly low-lying hills, and then over the top of those hills you'd be able to see the coastline of the Mediterranean. And there we have once again the steep incline from the valley floor up to the top of the hilltop. We went to great extents to, we mentioned the Phoenician work that took place, and the fact that the architectures were from Phoenicia or Tyre and Sidon. So this next slide shows one of those. No, it doesn't. The one up for this book. This just shows you the different layers of Samaria, of the actual walls. And as we said before, the actual way and the design that the walls were done proved that Phoenician architecture was one of the main attributes to it. Thanks, Nick. Okay, there we have one of those Phoenician architectures, looking at his work and very pleased. I'm not quite sure his name, but there you go. But once again, just a close-up of the walls and the style of walls that encompass the city. Excuse the next slide, but that just shows in a fairly prominent fashion the way that Samaria rose from the valley floor. And of course, any nation coming against it would have to siege it for a long time, as indeed the Assyrians tried to do so for 3 years before they took it. And the next slide just drops back a bit from that and has a look at it from a wider view from the valley. And as you can see, it commands a fairly prominent view from that direction. And if you can, that kind of view went all the way around the actual hilltop of Samaria, so it wasn't just this view looking towards it, but all the way around it. So there's just a few slides that will give you some kind of grasp of what the actual hill of Samaria looked like. So if we have the slide projector off and the lights on, I'll just finish by just reading a few verses from the reading that we had, Isaiah chapter 28, showing that although the Jews put their full strength and hope and they were full of pride in regards to this city of Samaria and its fortress-like position, where God says to them, "Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which are on the head of the fat bellies of them that are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one, which is a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, as a flood of mighty waters overflowing shall cast down to the earth with the hand. The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, shall be trodden underfoot, and the glorious beauty which is on the head of the fat belly shall be a fading flower, and as the hasty fruit before the summer, which, when he that looketh upon it seeth, while it is yet in his hand, he eateth it up." So we'll leave it at that and let Uncle Brian come forward and give us an explanation on what Isaiah chapter 28 is all about.
Thanks for that background, Glenn. That was very interesting, and I'm sure Uncle Brian will now build on that as he considers Isaiah chapter 28. This is the rest and this is the refreshing.
My dear class members, and a special welcome to our visitors from afar, both from Canada and closer at home from New Zealand. It's very nice to have our visitors from afar. Thank you too, Glenn, for the very good coverage you've given of a remarkable city, one of the greatest cities of the Old Testament, the capital city for the most period of that northern kingdom, and a great city it was, wasn't it? A really wonderfully strategically located city. Now, when we turn to the 28th chapter and contemplate why that background is relevant, we notice in verse 1 that there's a description of something particularly beautiful. It doesn't tell us anything about Ephraim in verse 1. It says, "Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards," sorry, it does, "the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower." And it's the expression which follows which has made almost every commentator consider that this is a reference to the capital of Ephraim. It says, "which are on the head of the fat valleys of them that are overcome with wine." And verse 4 repeats that grand description. And so if you have your little breakup of the chapter here, my dear and sisters, Isaiah chapter 28, you will see that we've headed up this first section, "Woe to the drunkards of Ephraim who were inhabiting that very wonderful city." I mean, as a location, it made Jerusalem seem like, as though it might pale into significance. So beautiful was the situation of this remarkable city of Samaria. Now, just picking up the context of chapter 28 in its section here in Isaiah, we really have finished in chapter 27 one of our sections. You'll notice that chapter 28 begins differently, doesn't it? "Woe to the crown of pride." And when we turn over to chapter 29 and verse 1, that also begins the same way. We notice in verse 15, there is another opening statement. "Woe unto them that seek deep to hide their counsel from Yahweh, and their works are in the dark." So that's three sections beginning with woe. Also chapter 30 and verse 1, the same thing. Chapter 31 begins the same way. And chapter 33 also. Now those six reiterations of the word woe seem to put this section, do they not, into its own grouping. Now, I think that's a reasonable observation. It was not like that before. Now we have this grouping of six chapters all coming together. Now, coming back then to chapter 28 and ask ourselves one or two questions. What does this prophet speak in verse 2 then? If this is about Samaria, then of what power is he speaking in verse 2 when he says, "Behold, the Lord hath a mighty and strong one, which is a tempest of hail and a devouring, destroying storm, as a flood of mighty waters overflowing, shall cast down to the earth with the hand." Of what power does he speak? Well, the power that did destroy, of course, the northern kingdom and its capital was the power of Assyria. If we look at the other sections in the woe chapters, right, this book of woes, as somebody once called it, if we look at the other little bits and pieces that are jotted through the record that specifically indicate to whom it is spoken, then we come to these conclusions. Chapter 29, verse 1. That's to the city of Jerusalem, to Ariel. To Ariel, the city where David dwelt. That's very specific, isn't it? So chapter 29 is spoken to Jerusalem. So too is chapter 28 and verse 14. "Wherefore hear the word of Yahweh, ye scornful men that rule this people which is in Jerusalem." So too, when we look at chapter 29, verse 5 and 6. "Moreover, the multitude of thy strangers shall be like small dust, and the multitude of the terrible ones shall be as chaff that passeth away. Yea, it shall be at an instant suddenly, Thou shalt be visited of Yahweh of hosts with thunder, with earthquake and great noise, with storm and tempest and the flame of devouring fire. We wouldn't have difficulty in saying what that power was that came against Jerusalem and was taken in a moment, would we? We'd have no difficulty at all. That's Sennacherib. But it was not Sennacherib who conquered the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom was gone before Sennacherib. It was Shalmaneser that came against the northern kingdom some 10 years before. Chapter 30. Just to make it clear, my dear brothers and sisters, that this is about the Sennacherib invasion. In Isaiah 30 then, and verse 2 and 3, that walked to go down into Egypt, it's against Judah, and have not asked at my mouth, to strengthen themselves in the strength of Pharaoh, and to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the strength of Pharaoh be your shame, and the trust in the shadow of Egypt your confusion. We know what all that's about. It's that duplicity that Judah carried on. When she knew that Assyria was coming down, she thought that she might be able to offset that by suddenly making an alliance with Egypt. But she already had an agreement with Assyria in the north. It was this duplicity that is so much found, and we've seen it already, haven't we, often, in Isaiah. Chapter 30, verse 31. For through the voice of Yahweh shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. Chapter 31, verse 1. Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help and stay on horses and trust in chariots. So chapter 31 is on a similar line, isn't it, to chapter 30. This epoch of Assyrian invasion coming upon Judah, and this is a warning to Judah as they prepare for that event. And so Judah is being warned about their duplicity of diplomacy. In chapter 33 now, verse 14, just going to the last of these woe chapters. The sinners in Zion are afraid. The fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? Now we just run through that section of the woe chapters, see, to try and pick up what the main throb of that section is. The woe passages are concerning the Assyrian invasion of Judah that occurred in the days of Hezekiah. Now let's just put that up, just so everybody's quite clear about that. The woe chapters are set against Sennacherib's invasion of Assyria, against Judah. Now, having got that clear, all right, that's what the woe chapters are about. That's the period they're going to involve. Now, having got that clear, when you go back then to chapter 28, it helps us to get this verse in its right context. In chapter 28 and verse 2, it speaks of an invasion not upon Judah, but upon Ephraim. And it says in verse 2 that there's going to be an overflowing flood which is going to come down upon that land, and Ephraim is still in existence. Verse 3. The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim shall be trodden under feet. Conclusion, they have not yet been trodden under feet. So then, whilst the woe chapters are about Sennacherib's invasion of Syria, this is, in these verses, speaking of an earlier time that has not yet come, when Shalmaneser will come against the northern kingdom. So that helps us to get the exact position of chapter 28. Now, just to give you some idea of how all that fits together in time sequence, was in the fourth of Hezekiah that Shalmaneser came down. That's right, the fourth of Hezekiah that Shalmaneser came down. And it was in the seventh of Hezekiah that Samaria fell. As Glenn has already told us, there were 3 years to take that great city. Possible, really, 3 years. That's longer than it took Rome to take Jerusalem. That was a 2 year siege, wasn't it? 68 to 70. 3 years to take Samaria. So that goes from the fourth of Hezekiah to the seventh of Hezekiah. But the invasion of Sennacherib is not until the 14th of Hezekiah. So there are 10 years from Shalmaneser's invasion to Sennacherib's. And therefore chapter 28 must be in the build-up of this. That is, we're going towards the time when Shalmaneser will invade. It cannot be before Shalmaneser's invasion, because Samaria is still in existence. That third and fourth verse make that overwhelmingly clear. So before Hezekiah, we had the king Ahaz. So it was probably in his reign that this chapter occurred. Here we are. Before Hezekiah, we have King Ahaz. And many of the things in this chapter would fit his period of time beautifully, perfectly. So that might help us to get the sense of our chapter 28. It was given, therefore, considerably before Sennacherib's invasion. It gave Judah considerable time, didn't it, to prepare for the invasion, the terrible invasion of Sennacherib. In fact, it may not have been Shalmaneser that completed the taking of Samaria. There's this question of that. Shalmaneser never claimed it. Scripture doesn't actually say so. It may have been Sargon, the next of the Assyrian kings, that actually took Samaria. He rose up against Shalmaneser and defeated him. Now, the record of that, I'll just turn to it so that you can fill it in later. It's found in the record of Kings. In the 2nd of Kings, chapter 16 and 17 and 18. We won't be looking that up, but that's the record that you want. 2 Kings 17 and verse 6 says, "In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Halah and in Habor by the river in Gozan and in the cities of the Medes. And it was done by Shalmaneser," verse 3, "king of Assyria." That's the ninth year of Hoshea. So the northern kingdom was had a man at the time of Hezekiah's seventh year, had a man whose name was Hoshea, and it was his ninth year when the city fell. So it was invaded by the Assyrians in his sixth year, 3 years before. All right. So, when we come therefore to verse 2, our understanding would be that that is a reference to Shalmaneser and not to Sennacherib. The reason being that Ephraim is still intact in verse 3. Now, Glenn has amply described, hasn't he, the beauty of that city. It's emphasised dramatically in verse 1. And if you just keep your hand there, turn to the prophet Amos, who was contemporary with Isaiah. And you'll see that the description here is remarkably similar to what we have in Isaiah 28. Woe to them, verse 1, that are at ease in Zion and trust in the mountain of Samaria, who are named chief of the nations to whom the house of Israel came. This is Amos 6, verse 1. Pass ye unto Calne and see, and from thence go ye to Hamath the great. Then go down to Gath of the Philistines. Be they better than these kingdoms? In other words, will Zion and Samaria succeed and be unconquered when these other great kingdoms fell before the Assyrians? Or their border greater than your border? Either put far away the evil day and cause the seat of violence to come near, that lie upon beds of ivory and stretch themselves upon their couches and eat the lambs out of the flock and the calves out of the midst of the stall. You can see these men, can't you, just lolling back and having the best luxuries of life, stretching themselves upon their couches, that chant to the sound of the viol, verse 5. They've got their music, and invent to themselves instruments of music like David, not prepared to use David's instruments, but they like to have his fame, so they make him another batch of instruments that were foreign to Israel, that drink wine in bowls and anoint themselves with the chief ointments. To cover up how much they smell, I suppose. But they are not grieved for the affliction of Joseph. A tragic situation is there described. Now that's the drunkards of Ephraim in Isaiah chapter 28 and verse 1. A graphic description. There they were in this magnificent colonnaded streets, beautiful palaces, ivory patterned work worked into that city. In fact, when you visit that city today, you can see the little bits of ivory in the ruins. We found little pieces in those very ruins. And there was the evidence of Phoenician architecture in that city, all through it. It was an exceedingly beautiful place. So reeling back at all the luxury and pride of that place, for it had done very, very well, were these men feasting, drinking and luxuriating with the best of the land. Now that licentious indulgence, verse 2, was going to be dealt with by God in a figure of a destroying storm, a flood of mighty waters overflowing. Now, do you remember in chapter 8 that same figure was used of Assyria? In Isaiah 8, in verse 6 to 8, for as much as this people refuseth the waters of Shiloh that go softly, and rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son. That is to say, they were concerning themselves about the king of the northern kingdom and the king of Syria, and neglecting what God had provided for them in the waters of Shiloh. Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, and even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go up over all his banks, and he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over, he shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of thy land, O Emmanuel. Now there's the prophecy of Sennacherib's invasion. Shalmaneser may well be incorporated in that, but essentially that's going to be Sennacherib. And you notice, remember how that when we were dealing with this section, the waters came to the neck. They did not entirely submerge that southern kingdom. Judah was saved because its capital was saved. They came all around the city. They took the countryside of Judah, but its capital was saved. And so there was a very accurate and intriguing description of the invasion of Sennacherib. Now that's the same figure of speech for Assyria that we have in this 28th chapter. Now while we're back in chapter 28, he doesn't leave that description there. Look in verse 15. We have made a covenant with death, they said, and with hell are we at agreement. To which God says, when the overflowing scourge shall pass through. Sorry, this is still their comment about how they would survive. When the overflowing scourge that you've spoken about, Isaiah in verse 2, when it comes to pass, it shall not come unto us. For we have made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves. And the figure appears again in chapter 17, in verse 17. Judgment also will I lay to the line, and righteousness to the plummet, and the hail of verse 2, shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters of verse 2 shall overflow the hiding place. And your covenant with death that shall be disannulled, and your agreement with hell shall not stand when the overflowing scourge shall pass through. Then yet shall ye be trodden down by it. From the time that it goeth forth, it shall take you. For morning by morning shall it pass over, by day and by night, and it shall be a vexation only to understand the report. Nothing can stand before floodwaters, can they? They just sweep everything along with them. And so it was. Even though it took 3 years for Assyria to be taken, the floodwaters of the mighty northern host eventually swept that great city into oblivion. And it's been like that ever since, hasn't it? It's a city of no significance today. There the trees and the beasts of the field and so forth graze. It has lost indeed its one time very great beauty. Now that's spoken of in verse 4. And the glorious beauty which is on the head of the fat valley, picking up the terms you see of verse 1, shall be a fading flower. That's a graphic little description, isn't it? You know, I don't know how you feel about flowers, but I just love a room to have some flowers in. And I'm always at my girls at work, they've got to have flowers in my room. But you know, there's nothing worse than dead flowers, is there? It's all the difference in the world, isn't it? They can add such a lot to a room. But if they're dead flowers, there's nothing you want to do quicker than get hold of the things and throw them out. Because what was once so beautiful is, when it's a fading flower, just so detestable. And that's the strength of this verse 4. What was so beautiful before is now something that you hurry to throw out and discard. And the same sense of haste is involved in the rest of that verse. As the hasty fruit before the summer, which when he that looketh upon it seeth, while it is yet in his hand, he eateth it up. What's that speaking about? It's in other places described as the first ripe fig. It's the Hebrew word bikur, B-I-K-K-U-R. And here's where it's used, Micah chapter 7. Woe is me, for I am as when they have gathered the summer fruits, as the great gleanings of the vintage. There is no cluster to eat. My soul desired the first ripe fruit. That's the same expression. The first ripe fruit. You've got the same thing in Hosea. Hosea 9, verse 10. This shows God's desire for Israel. He likens it to this first ripe fig. I found Israel, he says in Hosea 9 verse 10, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first time. But they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves and so on. You know, when you go out at the early time of summer and the apricots are setting on the tree, and you're watching, watching, watching. The sun comes out a little bit hotter each day until eventually you think, I reckon that one's just about ready. And you try it, no, it's not quite ready. Go back a few days later and yes, it's getting soft enough. Probably soft because everyone else is trying the same one. But it's something delectable in the first ripe apricot, isn't it? Or whatever other tree it might be. You wait, wait, wait for all through winter, through spring and then early summer, and now it's ready. Before, in fact, you've got time to take it home to give it to your children. You've eaten it. So that's the figure, isn't it, that is here being described. Which when he that looketh upon it seeth, while it is yet in his hand, he eateth it up. Your beauty, Samaria, will only encourage the king of the north. When he sees that beauty, he will say, I want it. Your wonderful fortress city, with all of its beautiful architectural trappings, is going to be but an attraction to Shalmaneser when he comes down. You'll notice that it's spoken of as a crown of pride, a glorious beauty, a crown of pride, a glorious beauty in verse 1. You might think, well, why was the northern kingdom so eloquently described Why was the prophet so emphatic about its greatness? Well, it had done great things. We won't turn this up, but just make a little reference there. 2 Chronicles 28 and verse 6 says that that kingdom in the days of Ahaz had slain of Judah in one day 120,000 men. Do you think there'd be some pride in that city? What's more, in verse 8 of that same chapter, 2 Chronicles 28 verse 8, they took 200,000 captives, men, women and children, back to the city of Samaria. And they're all outside that city that we saw on that slide. 200,000 of Judah in absolute humiliation were outside of that city. You know, Isaiah chapter 7 says that this northern kingdom, they thought they were going to come down with Syria, they were going to come down to Jerusalem, and they were going to replace that throne. That Yahweh had spoken to David in truth concerning that city and concerning his seed in that city. And Isaiah 7 is directed to the house of David, and the plan of those invaders, Syria of the north and Israel of the north from Samaria, was that they were going to come down and replace that king and put Tabeel in his place. What a pride. What an assumption. Now you can understand, can't you, how God picks all that up. He understood them. He saw them exactly for what they were, lying back in all their couches and having the best of the land, drunk and stupid, and thinking they could just about do what they liked through their politics with other powers, and because of their great wealth and the great bounty of their valleys in which their city was situated. So it's a very graphic description, isn't it? I'm sure made more vivid because of the pictorial work that we had tonight. Now, these following verses are very beautiful. They pick up the language of what we've got in the earlier verses and they apply it in a very beautiful way. Watch carefully in verse 5. You've got your little breakup of the chapter, verses 5 to 6. Yahweh, a crown of glory. Talking about a glorious beauty and a crown of pride. In that day, verse 5, shall Yahweh of hosts, which expresses, doesn't, his determination to use his strength, Yahweh of armies, sometimes we speak of it, to use his strength on behalf of his people, Yahweh of hosts shall be for a crown of glory and for a diadem of beauty when Samaria has gone. The divine beauty will shine forth when the human beauty has gone. For whom, my dear brothers and sisters, would Yahweh be a crown of glory? What a magnificent thought that is. You know what a crown is? It sits on the head, doesn't it? And what this is saying is that upon these people that are redeemed from that terrible invasion, upon those people, God, creator of heaven and earth, he will rest as a crown of glory upon their head, and as a diadem of beauty unto the residue of his people. That's the people. Now the term that we have there, residue of his people, is the same word that we found all through the book of Isaiah. It's one of the great words of Isaiah. It's the word sheer. I only put that up because it helps us to get a handle to things, doesn't it? And that's the word we find for remnant. Remnant. That's one of Isaiah's great themes. For example, if you come back to the very chapter we dealt with last time, verse 12. It shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. That's the terms of the gleanings. It's that word beat off is the very word which is used of the gleanings. And the gleanings were a remnant, weren't they, that was left after the crop had gone. It shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria. They're all doing a Jacob, as it were, because that expression is used of him. Ready to perish in the land of Assyria. Deuteronomy 26 and verse 5. They've all done a Jacob who went away and was ready to perish in the land of Assyria. But God benefited him greatly and aggrandized him and brought him back to the land as a very great host of people. So the remnant will come back very greatly multiplied. And the famous chapter, chapter 10, concerning the remnant. Chapter 10 and verse 20, it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant, the sheer of Israel, and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob, shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, that is upon Assyria, but shall stay upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. The sheer shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decree shall overflow with righteousness. And that's a great theme in Isaiah. There's two sides to that verse 22. Did you see that? Two sides to it. On the one hand, it's catastrophic. It's only a remnant. But on the other hand, it is a remnant. That's the two sides to it. You see, verse 21 is promising that there would be a remnant. But 22 is saying only a remnant. And you know, that is just how Isaiah deals with it right throughout his book. That's how God really deals with his people. This wonderful crowning of these people is unto the remnant of his people. So that's very beautiful, isn't it? Very beautiful indeed. You may ask, what remnant? Well, he hasn't really specified that, has he? But I would say that since we've just come out of verses 1 to 4, which have to do with Samaria, it may well be that it's some of that kind of 7,000 of which Elijah was involved in the northern kingdom. Not indeed only of them, because the chapter goes on, as we've already indicated, verse 14, to be directed to Jerusalem. But would it not be reasonable, having said verses 1 to 4, and then playing upon the very terms in verse 5 of the crown and the diadem, would it not be reasonable that now these people have gone through right through the history of the northern kingdom, the whole 250 years of it, and there are still some that have not bowed the knee unto Baal, of which Elijah was told, and Yahweh becomes to them a crown of glory, a diadem of beauty? Well, we don't know exactly. Certainly it's going to include some from Judah, but I think coming in that way, it's very likely that he's saying, and I can still see my people among the northern kingdom that I will save in that day. The widows of Zarephath and so on. And then in verse 6, he says, and for a spirit of judgment to him that sitteth in judgment, and for strength to them that turn the battle to the gate. What's the sense of that, my dear brothers and sisters? Well, he's saying that God's going to bring some measure of justice to things. The justice is not there at the present time. It was the priest that sat in judgment, but the priest was, if you look at verse 7, the priest and the prophet have erred through strong drink. They didn't have judgment. They are swallowed up of wine. They are out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. But a spirit of judgment is going to come to him who is the judge of the land in that day. There's going to come a correct balance, as it should be. Then the next phrase is interesting. If the first half of verse 6 is a solace to internal problems, internal justice, the last half is a solace to those who feared invasion from external sources. For he's also going to be, for strength, Yahweh of hosts is, for strength to them that turn the battle to the gate. Or as the Revised Standard Version says, that turn back the battle at the gate. You know, when the battle comes to the gate, it's mighty desperate, isn't it? It's one thing to fight the battle, you know, 20, 30 miles away from your city. But when you're pressed and pressed and pressed back, and you're right alongside your own gate, it's a very wonderful deliverance, isn't it? That God could provide, that will then allow that person to find resource to push back that enemy and save the people despite the precarious situation in which they found themselves. And that's the figure So inside there, he's going to be like a spirit of judgment. People will be able to find equity and decency. Justice will prevail. And also, he will defend that city and push the enemy away, even from the very gate itself. Now, that's just brimming over with thoughts, isn't it? When was the time that the enemy came to the very gate? Well, surely it's got to be Hezekiah's time. Isn't that a graphic description? To the very gate, there was Rabshakeh with all of his blasphemy, speaking his words to the king Hezekiah, faithful king Hezekiah, who went and took them to Isaiah. The city was all enervated by the precarious nature of their situation. And they would read little passages like this, that Yahweh of hosts promised that he would be for strength to them to turn the battle from the gate. And he did, didn't he? The following morning, 185,000 of them were dead in the valley outside Israel. So there is a wonderful echo of these things. A spirit of judgment to him that sitteth in judgment. Quickly over to 29, verse 21, just to give us some idea of why he needed to say that. See, justice did not prevail. In 29:21, they that make a man an offender for a word, and lay a snare for him that reproveth in the gate, and turn aside the just for a thing of naught, for those things will go. In the third chapter, 2, chapter 3, verse 12 to 14. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err, and destroy the way of thy paths. The Lord standeth up to plead, and standeth to judge his people. Yahweh will enter into judgment with the ancients of his people and the princes thereof, for he have eaten up the vineyard, and so forth. So there was a need for this spirit of judgment to enter into the mind of the judge in the land. Well, verses 7 to 8, we've entitled Jerusalem's Bespotted Leadership, and they really speak for themselves. They also have erred through wine and through strong drink are out of the way. The priest and the prophet have erred through strong drink. The ones who should have had their minds about their duties and responsibilities, the principal leaders of the nation, were more concerned and interested in the bottle than they were in delivering justice to people. They are swallowed up of wine. They've swallowed the wine, but the wine, in fact, has swallowed them up. They are out of the way through strong drink. They err in vision. They stumble in judgment. And verse 8 means that in those tables that were in the courts of the temple where people came to eat a meal with God, the peace offering was shared, wasn't it, with the family or whosoever brought the offering, and they, as it were, had a meal with God. But when they looked around for a place to conduct such a holy meal, there was nothing, for it was occupied by priests and by prophets and by leaders of the land, that had turned the place into a sort of a modern day restaurant, a place of debauchery, and even their vomit and filth was upon the table places. So in verses 9 to 13 we have a very dire warning to the people. You have your little piece of paper there. Our heading for that is Infantile Understanding Portends Destruction. And verses 9 and 10, the prophet bemoans the fact that he's not able to speak to the people in a mature way. Whom shall he teach knowledge? Can you teach little infants? Whom shall he make to understand doctrine? This grave dilemma in which the prophet found himself. Can God speak unto those that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breasts? You can't teach doctrine, can you, to the little ones? Our little ones are here tonight, some, but they're asleep. They can't comprehend these matters. For, says the prophet, lamenting in verse 10, precept must be upon precept. It's like teaching the junior Sunday school class. Precept upon precept. Precept upon precept. Line upon line. Line upon line. Here a little and there a little. It's like a little song, a little ditty that is mocking these people who, though perhaps wealthy and strong in themselves, capable people, rich potential, yet had never had never grown to fulfil the potential they should have had, and so in understanding they were babes. For with stammering lips and another tongue will he speak to this people, to whom he said, "This is the rest wherewith ye may cause the weary to rest, and this is the refreshing," yet they would not hear. God offered them to sit and to grow in the things of God, but they spurned that opportunity and said, "We don't want that. We want our wine. We want our lascivious life. We're not prepared to grow in the great things of God." And so they would not therefore have the rest that he promised them. But the word of Yahweh was unto them, precept upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. My dear brothers and sisters, that is not, it is not a statement about how we should learn the Bible. It may be true that children in younger years do learn the Bible like that. But that is not a statement of advocacy, is that that's how we ought to learn it in our maturity of years. And the force of that is seen by the conclusion of the verse. The result of that kind of attitude, of say turning our Bible class into what often I used to see in my earlier years, it would be a class of no substance. It used to grieve me that there was so little substance in the Bible class. We were never called to be a people infantile in understanding. You know, rare sort of subjects all over the Bible, any other night. Anybody getting up and speaking. It was never what God intended. He intended that there should be maturity of understanding. And that we should, as a people, grow in the things of God. Not being happy to be infantile in our understanding. What's the conclusion of infantile understanding? That they might go and fall backward. And be broken and snared and taken. And that, of course, is what has happened so many times. When there has been a lack of attention to the things of God, and there's no real throb of interest about the things of God, that people decline. Where there is a grave and loving interest in the things of God, and people speak to each other about those things, that ecclesia, that body, will grow, and it will have the blessing of God within it. We've had to move along through those verses fairly carefully, fairly quickly, but we'll leave it at that. Thank you.